303-720-6001. The EMS Garage for July 21st, 2009. The air I breathe.
No transport patient machine.
The EMS Garage.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the EMS Garage. Yes, I'm back. Thanks, Buck, for hosting. You rock, dude. And by the way, I just want to say to everybody that I may have a face for radio, and you definitely have a voice for radio. Because man, I listened to that podcast last week. That was good. So I can never, I can't outdo you, man. So Buck, I'm going to introduce you first. Buck Ferris, the awesome man behind a lot of the tech here.
You.
Oh, you're here. I can hear you. Hello, Buck. Well, he lost us, but we're still listening to Buck. So maybe he'll talk here in a minute. Buck, are you back? Whatever. Rob Terrio from Ontario, but tonight in Orlando. Hello, sir.
Hi, Chris. How are you guys?
We're good. We're very good.
Good to be back.
Right on. So did you guys drive?
We drove, yeah. Ooh. We flew to Disney World 2 years ago. We decided to drive this time. So we took our time. We did a three-day trip, and the scenery was great. We've really enjoyed it. So we just arrived today, and we're at the Wilderness Lodge for the next 7 days.
And is the Wilderness Lodge actually in the...
It is, yeah.
Inside the park itself?
Yep.
Nice.
Yep, it's inside the park, yeah. Yep, so we're up at 6 a.m. tomorrow to head down to... the parks.
Cool. Wow. That's a full day. Have you already, Did you hit them today as well?
No, we just went to sort of downtown Disney, did a little shopping this afternoon, and then just came back to our hotel for a little swim.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Right on. And, well, thank you for joining us, Rob, tonight. And even though you're on vacation, that's more than I could do when I was on vacation a week ago. And Mr. Mark Glencourse, hello, sir, all the way from the UK at 3:15 GMT. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. And what have you been up to? Are you working? Are you taking any... Have you been... You were on holiday not too long ago. You went to Spain, right?
Yeah, been back just did about 3 or 4 weeks worth of shifts, and now I'm on holiday again. So
where are you going? Are you doing anything fun, or are you just hanging out?
No, just away from work this time. So I thought there's nothing better to do on me week's annual leave than wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, come and talk to you guys.
Oh wow, very nice. Well, that sounds lovely.
Well, I'm managing to stay awake.
Well, thanks for joining us so late. And Mr. Gary Wingrove from Boston tonight. Hello from the AAA conference.
Good evening.
And how are you doing?
I'm hanging in there.
You are?
You are? Yep.
Sorry.
It was a nice weekend at home.
It was. Oh, and it was your wife's 40th birthday, right?
Last week, yeah, that's right. The party's
nice.
Saturday. We're all invited.
Did you have a big one? Oh, it's coming.
It's coming up, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Right on. Very nice, very nice. Well, thank you for joining us, Gary. I feel like it's been forever since I've heard your voice, at least since last Friday. And, Buck, are you there now?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I dropped out for a minute there.
You had a little brain fart. But hey, I just wanted to give you a 20-second plug for your new show.
Oh, yeah. Copy Code 3 launched yesterday. And, you know, I already thought I'd have more listeners than the garage now, so I'm disappointed.
Had
about 200
snap.
People. Ooh, yeah. No, we had about 200 people listen to it yesterday. And it's a good EMS story show, a little bit different, not the same format. But we, our first episode was about a soldier, who used to be a paramedic and, went to Iraq and, got blown up in a shower and was told he would never work again. He would be disabled for the rest of his life. And he went back to paramedic school and is now on the street. And we're gonna have a lot of stories from, different people, different professionals, and a lot of the shows that are coming up, in the future. Are themes. We're going to have one, say, on, you know, the worst nursing home calls you've ever run, and we'll let four or five people tell their stories, and the worst scene safety issues and things like that. And it's a little bit different format, and I hope it works well. CopyCode3.com. Come by and check it out. And, Mark, you said something so nice about it. We really appreciate that on your blog.
I enjoyed listening to it. It was a very interesting story.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Buck, and I think it's important that you let everybody know that it's CopyCode3 with the 3 spelled out .com, because if you go to CopyCode3...
Oh, the 3 spelled out...
It doesn't work.
Yeah. If you spell out CopyCode3, you get there. After a while, you will be able to type in CopyCode number 3 and get there, but I broke it. So in the next couple of days, whatever you type, you'll be able to get there. But for right now, CopyCode3 spelled out, there you go.
Oh, very nice. Well, and I'm very excited about your new project. I've had a chance to listen to it, and I think it's awesome. So go there now,
well,
but always
you.
Listen to our podcast first, and then go there and download it. Or you could download it while you're listening to you. You go to iTunes and download us, and then subscribe to Buck's new podcast. Hopefully Rob will have a new one, too. Everybody will have a podcast. Podcasting for everybody! Well,
awesome.
the real reason we're talking tonight is we wanted to talk about a article that Mark sent around this past week talking about how maybe we should, and I'm going to be the sensational journalist I can be, we shouldn't give oxygen to anybody anymore. Is that right, Mark?
Not quite, but we should certainly relook at who we're giving oxygen to and why. The article I initially sent around was actually our new guidelines, which come from people called the Joint Royal College Ambulance Liaison Committee, who are our sort of profession leaders, and they tell us what to do and how to do it. And they've just given us a new update in April of this year, which is just starting to filter down to us now. And basically it changes what we used to do from, I guess as most EMS providers, if we get someone who's poorly, we tend to just immediately stick on 100% oxygen because that's what we've always done and that's what we should be doing. But now there's been a lot of research done over the past few years, accumulating in a 81-page paper which came from the British Thoracic Society, which changes how we do things, and GRCalc picked that up and passed it down to us. Now, in its most simplest form, things have been changed into four different groups of patients. We have one group of patient which does get 100% oxygen straight away. And these are the patients who are either in cardiac arrest or who have a major trauma, so any of the big abdominal traumas or face, neck trauma, everything like that. Anaphylaxis, major pulmonary hemorrhage, sepsis, and actively convulsing and hypothermia. So they get 100% oxygen to get them within the realms of 94 to 98% oxygen pulse oximetry. And then the next one we've got is moderate levels of supplemental oxygen for those with serious illnesses and who are hypoxemic. But again, this has changed just slightly in that they're trying to get the oxygen saturation levels in between the 94 and 98 again, and instead of 100% for everybody, they're wanting us to use nasal cannula and simple face masks. And this is for patients who are acutely hypoxemic, if they've got a deterioration of a lung fibrosis condition, if they've got acute asthma, acute heart failure, pneumonia, lung cancer, those sort of things, they get oxygen straight away. But as soon as they're up to the 94 to 98% mark on pulse oximetry, then we alter the oxygen just to keep them within those realms. The third one, which we've all known about anyway, and which has always been a bone of contention, has been for the patients who have got COPD or other conditions requiring controlled low-dose oxygen therapy. And for this, the GRCalc are now saying that pre-hospitally we need to keep their oxygen saturations between 88 and 92%. So there's no longer 100% oxygen for them. We always used to have a bit of conflict in that, as paramedics used to go out and the respiratory nurses used to say, you know, you can't have them on 100% oxygen, but we were always led to believe that it's absolutely fine pre-hospital. There's not enough time for us to deliver so much oxygen that will influence their hypoxic drive. But that's been proven otherwise. So with this one, for these patients, we just give 4 liters per minute via their own Venturi oxygen masks, which they should be getting and keeping at home, or via simple face mask or nasal cannula. And then the last one, which is the one which is causing the most discussion, is no oxygen required for adults with these conditions unless they're hypoxic. So MIs, heart attacks, strokes, cardiac rhythm disturbances, non-traumatic chest pain, birth imminent patients, vaginal bleeding, pregnancy-induced hypertension, abdo pains, such like just the general medical and emergencies, if the blood saturation levels are between 94 and 98%, they don't get any oxygen at all. And that's the main one, because that's causing obviously some conflict within our accident and emergency departments, because we're going in with people having heart attacks without any oxygen on. And if they're not aware of these new guidelines, which is does apply to them as well, it's to all hospitals, then it tends to have a bit of a discussion at the bedside as in why we're not putting oxygen on the patients. So that's over here now. It's just starting to filter through. And I sent it over to you guys just to see whether yous were doing that. I assumed that we were following something that the Americans were doing again, but apparently not. And what ensued was a very interesting, passionate discussion on the emails.
Yeah, I have one question right away. I know you probably don't want to speak and defend for the whole thing. But first off, when you started listening to all those things, you said that oxygen is one of the things that's being provided in is full arrest.
Yep.
And it would seem like if you're talking about free radicals and everything, that and you're following this line of reasoning, that full arrest would be one of the things you'd want to go with room air with. Was there any, am I just completely off base there, or what's going on?
There's no, I mean, I spent the early part of this evening reading through the big document from the British Thoracic Society, trying to understand things a bit more. I couldn't find anything specifically that said why it was okay in full cardiac arrest, because, I mean, the discussion about the free radicals and stuff, that takes a real sort of backstep in the whole rationale for why they're doing this. There seems to be a lot of other things before that which they talk about. A lot of it, even in the main paper, they do admit that there hasn't been any significant trials surrounding oxygen therapy other than one in 1976 or something, but there's a lot of evidence out there which is either rhetorical or observed or small-scale trials, which is what they're working on, and they're just trying to use best practice at the minute. The free radical argument is discussed, but not specifically with the cardiac arrest. It does mention that that's the reperfusion injury mechanism and stuff like that, but there's nothing so much about the cardiac arrest. It just says on the documentation that for cardiac arrest, basic life support, ALS, foreign body airway obstruction, traumatic cardiac arrest, maternal resus, they all get maximum dose until the vital signs are normal. So I don't really
know. From the reading I was taking, it's like this is, it seemed like, well, one theory was that free radicals seemed to be the underlying cause of all this. And I may be wrong. But it seemed like if you're worried about reperfusion injury, the reason would is you're having dead tissue. And this seems to be a theme that's going on, too, and why cold resuscitation works. If you have a piece of dead tissue and so many, and if you want to call it free radicals or something else, that's okay. But as it starts to die or hits the Krebs cycle and starts to kind of go into anaerobic respiration, adding oxygen back to it can actually be a detriment. And that's why reperfusion injuries happen and other things. Now, it would seem that somebody in full arrest is guaranteed to be in that situation. And I get that was my concern about that. And I was just kind of wondering why the break in that. Have you guys identified, we think this is happening, this is why we're doing it, and we're not going with free radicals or other things? I was just kind of confused by the whole concept.
Well, I'm going to...
The other things that...
Go ahead.
Yeah, Chris?
Oh, well, all I was going to say...
as well as the... I mean, just to...
No, go ahead.
Yep.
We have a bit of a lag.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Okay. The only other things that they talk about is, the free radicals or reactive oxygen species they talk about slightly, but the main other reasons for sort of withholding oxygen for some patients was the evidence that they found that hyperoxemia relates to coronary and cerebral vasoconstriction, decreased cardiac output, absorption atelectasis, where the lung part of the lung can collapse, and also this idea that if you flood someone with oxygen, you can be giving them a good pulse oximetry, even, but in the background they're becoming hypercapnic and stuff. And that was a lot of what was coming onto it. The only other thing I can think of for the cardiac arrest is maybe Most of the things, most of the guidelines say that, you know, if they're very hypoxic, then you're going to give them oxygen to get them to the within the normal realms. So whether they're classing as needing to give 100% oxygen, because obviously after an arrest they're going to be so hypoxic that they need to sort of jumpstart things a little bit, I don't know. You know, that's for the medics, I guess, to argue that one.
Well, all I'm going to say is whoever wrote this protocol was clearly a nut. Clearly a UK protocol. There's sufficient evidence for role of O2 in general medical patients in the absence of hypoxia. Oximetry only measures hemosaturation. There's a value of 100% saturation as well as saturation in the plasma. Who's that? Dr. Keith Wesley. Just saying. I'm not very... I know I'm not very good at his voice, but that's what he wrote on in our... In the email that bounced back and forth, and basically he thinks that whoever wrote this was a nut. And then he had several really long dissertations on why it was crazy, so I'm not going to go into that.
But at least we had the opposing view as well. There was two sides of it. There was someone who actually thought it was a good idea. But, you know, it's just another case of Britain leading the way and you guys following, isn't it?
That always makes for a cogent argument, calling someone else a nut, you know, that you disagree with. I like that. That's a nice approach. You know, it's a radical change, but I'm inclined to side with the UK and their concept. I have a little bit of a problem with this idea of no oxygen, for example, acute MIs and even CVAs for that matter, because you know, we know that there are certain highly oxidative organs like the heart, which has, you know, an oxygen consumption something like 8 mils of O2 per 100 grams compared to, say, the brain, which is 3 mls, and the kidneys, I don't know, 5, 6 or something like that. So, you know, the literature I've read about oxygenation for acute MI patients talks about low liter flows, like 2 liters, 3 liters per minute, and in the long run, avoiding oxygenation because of the problems with oxygen-free radicals and the damage to myocardial cells. You know, patients who are oxygenated over the course of 2-3 days, but, you know, in the pre-hospital setting, when you're dealing with an ischemic myocardium, you know, Chris, the statement you made about oxygenating patients who are saturating 100% is true. You know, when we're talking about saturation, we're talking about how well hemoglobin is bound with oxygen molecules. We're not talking about oxygen dissolved in blood plasma. So patients who are saturating 100% who receive supplemental oxygen, or that oxygen becomes dissolved in blood plasma and gets utilized at the tissue level in a highly oxidative organ like the myocardium, you would think that there would be some benefit at least initially of a small amount of supplemental O2. I mean, we changed our protocol about 5 years ago from you know, giving acute MI patients a non-rebreather mask at 10 to 12 liters down to nasal prongs at 3 liters per minute. So I have a little bit of a struggle with this no oxygen at all for acute MIs too. I think I'd be one of those ER docs a little shocked to see those patients coming in with no O2. But yeah, I mean, don't know that the evidence is there.
One of our consultants at my local hospital, anyway, he's been harping on about this for the last couple of years, in that he keeps saying, you know, we've got someone who's saturating at 99%, and yes, they're having an MI, but they're still saturating at 99%, and the blood gases show that he is well oxygenated and such like. And he's been saying for a long time that this has been coming, and he keeps saying, you know, we take the patients in, he takes the oxygen off if they're fully oxygenated. And that seems to be the argument. I mean, it is coming in. I took my iPhone into work the other day with all the nice emails on from you guys and let a few of the doctors read through them all. And they had the same sort of feelings. They were unsure of it, but they're all aware as well that the next time they do their ALS updates, they're going to be using this as well, because it's just come out and it is a national thing and it's being led. I think reading the British Thoracic Society paper, the research that they used, they found 3,306 articles which were relating to this argument, and of those they used 184 direct research papers and reference papers to guide them on this protocol. And I guess over here it is now seen as that's best evidence-based practice for this use of oxygen now.
How can we say they're adequately oxygenated because their saturation is good, though? We're talking about an ischemic myocardium and where the supply is inadequate to meet the demands under those particular circumstances, you know, the condition of ischemia. So, you know, a saturation of 90% is good for a normal person, but someone who's got an ischemic myocardium, I'm not convinced.
Well, can I ask a question? I mean, haven't we found out that if you hyperoxygenate something over time, you actually... Hey, Gary, I'm getting a lot of feedback, man. I don't know if that's me or you. Anyway, if you hyperoxygenate yourself for a long time, you actually become hypercarbic, and then which leads to alkalosis. Are we now... I mean, wouldn't that whole same theory kind of hold true? And do you think that that's maybe what they're heading toward with this idea of free radicals and blah, blah, blah?
Well, you're talking about two different concepts. Well, number one, you're talking about over time, and that's not something that we play a role in the pre-hospital setting, because we're talking about a very short period of time. And number two, you know, hypercarbia and hyperoxygenation are two completely different concepts, right? The concept of ventilation is completely different from the concept of oxygenation, and that's a common source of confusion for people. Retaining CO2 is completely different from oxygenating or being, you know, hyperoxic or hypoxic.
Hyperoxic.
hyperoxic, thank you.
Okay, so that's what I meant. Not the hypercarbic. Well, okay, I don't know. Either way, the ones where you're breathing too fast, that one, you know what I mean.
They do mention that in the paper. That
really?
Specific thing, they mentioned that, and that's something me and my wife were talking about it, because she was trying to get her head around it as well. She's a paramedic as well. And she asked a question which I couldn't really answer that was in the British Thoracic Society thing. And one of the things that they get concerned about is if you're giving someone 100% oxygen, you can mask a major deterioration in the respiratory status of the patient. And the example they give is if you've got someone who's, say, had an opioid overdose and they're breathing at maybe 6 respirations a minute and you're banging in maximum oxygen for them. So you're getting a good SaO2 off them. However, in the background, which is hidden, is they're becoming hypercapnic and the CO2 levels are increasing and increasing and increasing. And that's one of the main arguments they give, this idea of masking a deterioration of a patient. And my wife was saying, well, how can you be hypercapnic when you've given lots and lots of oxygen? And it was quite hard to work through, and I still couldn't give a really good answer for that.
Well, you know, the two are related in the sense that if a patient is hyperventilated, you know, their O2 sats typically improve whether they're getting supplemental oxygen or not. But the two are completely different too, in the sense that ventilation affects CO2 and oxygenation affects PaO2, mm-hmm. right? So if you have a narcotic overdose who's breathing at a respiratory rate of 6 per minute and they have a sat of 70%, if you were to ventilate them, say, at a rate of 20 with a bag valve mask, without any supplemental oxygen whatsoever, then two things happen. Their CO2 will decrease as a result of the increase in minute volume, mm-hmm. and their PaO2 will increase by virtue of the fact that they've got a higher minute volume, they've got more alveoli getting ventilated, and so the surface area across which oxygen can diffuse is increased just by ventilation. But if I lost my train of thought here, but add supplemental O2, what will happen is the PaO2 will rise above that sort of standard 100, 80 to 100 millimeters of mercury, upwards of, to 200, 300, or 400. Increasing the minute volume, so increasing the rate of ventilation or the tidal volume, doesn't affect oxygenation anymore. What it simply does is it decreases CO2 to the point where they become hypocapnic, and that creates a whole series of problems.
Mm-hmm.
The reverse of that is sometimes, we hyperventilate people thinking that it oxygenates them, and that's not the case necessarily. You know, when we hyperventilate them, it's not the ventilation that increases oxygenation, it's the supplemental oxygen that we give them, with the exception of being, you know, the patient who's breathing at a rate of 6 and we're supplementing that. And then, of course, you know, as you suggested earlier, Chris, when you hyperventilate someone and you blow off too much CO2, they become alkalotic. And when they become alkalotic, hemoglobin tends to grab onto oxygen and hold on tight to it. And when it gets down to the cellular level, hemoglobin doesn't release it. So we may actually be compounding hypoxia by hyperventilating people. I mean, that's why, you know, back in the days of Johnny and Roy, they used to give 2 amps of bicarb to everyone. And, you know, the shift from metabolic acidosis to a metabolic alkalosis compounded hypoxia. That was the problem with that. And, you know, so is the problem with bagging the snot out of everyone. Yeah, you know, we put them into a metabolic alkalosis or a respiratory alkalosis rather, and that, prevents oxygen release at the tissue level.
Well, maybe we should have more of an open mind with this process because we have studied, I mean, I think acidosis has been studied ad nauseum versus this idea of too much oxygen, and you know, maybe we are causing more harm. And you know, Dr. Wesley, Brian Bledsoe wrote in our chat while we were bantering this back and forth, he said, well, Dr. Wesley still believes that the germ theory is controversial. So I mean, and I'm not going to take case with that, because maybe it's true, I don't know, but I really do think that maybe there is something to this, because it actually struck something with me when you said, we're giving people too much oxygen. I've kind of always felt that way, but, you know, because everybody always gets an underbreather. Let's throw them on that and just take them to the hospital. It's like, okay, do they really need that? No. And I think it's probably going to go the way the dodo bird.
Well, yeah, I think the problem is,
so what do you say?
What's that, Mark?
I was just saying, what is your current guidelines? Does everyone basically get 100%? And how do you manage your COPD patients who are very hypoxic, the ones that you get who have got stats of 70, 80? How would you actually manage them over there?
Well, I can tell you from experience, we don't, currently in my system, we don't deal with a lot of COPD patients, so I can't tell you how that would be dealt with here, but I give them oxygen. If they need it, they get it. And that's kind of always been the prevailing theory, that if they're at 78, you have to, A, fix the underlying cause, but B, you have to mm-hmm. kind of quickly turn that around, because, yeah, while their oxygen saturation is low, their brain tissue is going to start dying quicker, and their heart tissue is going to start suffering because of that low oxygen. So you have to correct that problem and then correct the underlying problem of the COPD exacerbation.
So I guess the question is, do we know that for sure, Chris? And number two is, how quickly do we need to reverse that, right? If a COPDer typically has an O2 sat of 89% or 88%, and then they have, you know, an acute exacerbation of their COPD, and we arrive and their SpO2 is now 86, and we really don't know exactly where it was before we arrived, other than the fact that they are a COPDer and they saturate low, you know, how rapidly do we need to reverse that? Is it really necessary to go with, you know, an honorary breather mask at 10 liters per minute? Or, you know, can we, as they're doing in the UK, start at 2-3 liters, 4 liters by nasal prongs and see how they respond to that?
See, and that's always been my theory, is you start low and work your way up. I think it should be the same with any medication.
Yeah.
Because it really is a medication. I mean, do you have to dump everything into the person at once? It's just like this idea.
Mm-hmm.
Of,
it is.
I mean, how many of us are old enough to remember when you gave epi, and then you gave high-dose epi, and then you gave very little epi, and now we're back to this point of, well, let's give some epi. And we've just kind of been through this whole gamut of everything, and, you know, some's okay. A lot's bad.
Yeah.
I think the interesting
except for the
COPD is the two.
Go ahead, Mark.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Then just to finish off with the COPD, the one thing that sort of made me really think about is, we've always known that maybe, you know, the respiratory nurses have always said, you know, get the 100% mask off them and such like. But certainly in the reading that I've been doing around in this, one of the articles that I did find, and that's mentioned in the documentation I sent around, is this thing that, you know, 47% of all patients with COPD who arrive in A&E departments in this country via ambulance, even after the short transport times, 47% of them were found to be clinically hypercapnic on arrival. You know, so even though it is just short-term oxygen therapy that we're giving them, it has had an effect. What's come out of the British Thoracic Society guidelines is they're all going to be given an oxygen alert card, which I don't know if you've seen it, but basically what it's going to say, it has their name on it, and then the text is, I am at risk of type 2 respiratory failure with a raised CO2 level. Please use my own, and they'll be issued with their own Venturi oxygen mask to give to the paramedics. Please use my own Venturi mask to achieve an oxygen saturation of, and then the clinician who's looking after them, the consultant, will actually prescribe what oxygen level we need to get them back to. So it's very much more of a, well, what's come out here, of this is know, oxygen is now going to be prescribed based on saturation readings. Go on.
And you know what, Mark? I don't disagree with this concept of lowering the amount of oxygen we deliver to COPDers, but here's where we're confusing these concepts again of oxygenation versus ventilation, because, you know, COPDers come in hypercapnic because they are chronically hypercapnic. You know, they, you know, normal CO2 is 35 to 45, and COPDers typically have CO2s in the 50, 55, 60 millimeters mercury range normally. So, and it's not administering supplemental oxygen that affects their CO2 levels either up or down. It's their ventilation. It's their tidal volume and their respiratory rate. And, you know, if we're not actually providing positive pressure ventilation, we're not having any impact on hyper or hypocapnia. So this is where I have a little trouble with the argument from the thoracic surgeons, if that's the argument they're making against supplemental O2. I do agree with lowering the supplemental O2 levels, but the hypercapnic argument just makes no sense to me, you know?
Okay.
So what's your feeling on the whole hypoxic drive theory then?
Well, the hypoxic drive theory is kind of a different concept as well, right? Because because their CO2s are chronically high, their chemoreceptors become insensitive to those high CO2 levels, so consequently they become more sensitive to low SpO2 levels or low oxygen levels. And so, you know, the theory is if we provide them with high supplemental O2, we knock out their drive to breathe, right? So, I mean, lowering their oxygen delivery sort of makes sense, but, if the argument against high levels of oxygen therapy or high concentration of oxygen therapy is hypercapnia, it just, to me, it makes no sense because they're two completely different concepts.
And I think that it's really over time. Aren't we talking that it takes time to get into that problem where the patient now, I mean, especially in COPD where you have that oxygen, primary oxygen drive that changes. So, I always found you could probably drown somebody in oxygen before they would change that drive, especially in the amount of transport times we're dealing with. I think if you're looking like 4, 5, 6, 8 hours, maybe. But not a couple, not 20, 40 minutes.
Yeah. Maybe so. But, you know, these patients are chronically saturated low, low 90s, high 80s. And so there's no real need to aggressively correct their SpO2 to 98%. You know, if we get them up around 90, you know, as Mark was suggesting, I think that's reasonable. And the supplemental O2 at 4 liters per minute, I think is perfectly fine. The other ones I have a little more difficulty with, like the acute MI patient, or, you know, anytime there's a decrease in the oxygen carrying capacity, you know, so. If a patient's, now maybe you can correct me on this, Mark, but do patients who have hemorrhage, do they qualify for a high concentration of oxygen? Patients who are hypovolemic?
They would come under the major trauma, so yes, they would. Anyone with major trauma, which you would get.
Does that make sense to me? Because that makes sense to me because they'll saturate at 100%, but their oxygen carrying capacity is, you know, markedly diminished, right? Because they've lost their hemoglobin.
Yeah, so that makes shock, it's shock is 15 litres per minute via non-rebreathe mask, so that's something we're going to agree on.
The pregnancy one I always have difficulty with, too, you know, because I'm so used to sort of routinely, you know, you get an obstetrical patient who's in premature labor or has had some complications along the way, and you want to give them even just oxygen by nasal prongs to, you know, just in the event that there's some fetal distress going on that you're unaware of. You know, I wonder where's the harm in administering supplemental O2 at a low level to an obstetrical patient who's in distress. And I mean, the ones we respond to 911 are typically the atypical pregnancies, right? They're the premature labor, they're the early ruptured membranes, they're the breech presentation, the you know, the placenta previas and the abruptio placentas. We don't get too many of the normal full-term pregnancies, you know, unless they just don't have a ride to the hospital. So I struggle a little with that one, too.
Plenty of them. But,
the other ones, you know, make so much sense to me. Yeah. But the other ones make sense to me.
Very cool. Yeah. Buck or Mark?
It's going to be an interesting time.
Do you have any last words on that, Mark? Buck, would you?
No, it's just, I just wanted to share. Sorry.
No, keep talking. Buck's audio's gone, so.
Oh, I think I'm back.
I just wanted to share it with you. There you are. Go on, number.
We're having a heck of a time tonight. I don't know what's going on with everybody's bandwidth. Buck, are you there?
I think can you hear me?
Yeah, now we can, yeah.
Well, here, I think I found out what happened. Oh, Windows just put out an update, like, right now. I've got four computers in my house trying to download updates to Windows right now. I'm running around. Actually, left for a minute trying to turn them all off. I don't know if that's affecting other people now or not.
It is Patch Tuesday, so that makes sense. So, Buck, do you have any thoughts on this oxygen theory?
Patch Tuesday?
It is Patch Tuesday. You've never heard of that? I thought all geeks had.
No, I haven't. I
like Microsoft has a Patch Tuesday once a month.
No, the second Tuesday of the month.
Yeah, although it's the thing, yeah. Isn't it?
It must be something serious, because if it's outside of the cycle, it means there's probably something bad they need to fix. I'm concerned about the whole thing. There are so many different reasons. It seems like, you know, there's a whole lot of free radical research. There's a whole lot of cold resuscitation research. It appears that the reason why the UK is doing this is for a completely different reason, a different set of studies that just generally says that, you know, this is bad for this situation, this is bad for that situation. I think what we're finding out is that, you know, in the realm of homeostasis, too much of anything is a bad thing. The stuff that really interests me more than any of this is that resuscitation might be changed forever by changing the way reperfused tissue accepts oxygen. And if we can get to the bottom of that problem, we might be able to actually raise the dead like we've been trying to for all these years. There's a few people that actually are on top of that and think they've got it down. And that's some fascinating research. The thing that concerns me is this new research coming from so many different quarters is that I know we're going to make some mistakes. Something's going to be put down, or something's going to be missed. For instance, it's obvious that in certain circumstances, giving oxygen would be great during, say, myocardial infarction. But there's a point at which you've gone too far, and adding oxygen in that tissue would be detrimental. But how do you recognize that in the field? How do you recognize that in the hospital? When do you give it and when do you not? And what's the set of criteria? One of the things that bothers me about what the UK has done is they seem to have hinged everything on pulse oximetry, which has been shown so many times to be just lacking as a vital sign, and easily fooled. And, I mean, a cold hand just ruins the entire thing, or poor perfusion in a finger, or something else. And it's, you know, I think it's a good idea. I think that the UK is kind of like the first penguin that's jumped in the water. Everybody's waiting to see whether the sharks are down there or not. And I like to see all the studies that are coming out about this. But I'm hopeful. I think we're on the right track. But I just, man, there's going to be a lot of argument over the next, I think, decade about this, and I everybody's gonna have a different take, and I think the average provider who doesn't really go around reading the new studies and everything are just gonna think everybody's cracked, and there's gonna be also a lot of just blind resistance to this, and everybody thinking we're nuts. I don't know. That's just what I've been thinking about. This is gonna be a long, hard road over the next, I think, 10 or 12 years before anybody makes any sense out of this.
Hey, Buck. Buck.
Yes.
They already think that.
Yes. Well, you know, I've been... you're right. You're right.
But that's so. Okay.
Yeah. So, do we lose everybody?
No, everybody else. No. Mark and Rob, okay. And everybody's still here. But so the last topic tonight I wanted to bring up is, and I'm sure Gary may have something to say about this, but this week, President Obama gave the nod, if you will, to Boston EMS Chief Richard. I don't know how to. Does anybody know how to pronounce his last name? Serino? Okay, nobody else is listening. Maybe it's
well, you're asking a Canadian. I have no idea.
Oh, right, right. Yeah. Terrio, Mr. Thoreau.
Obama, that's U.S. President. I know that much.
You know that much. So, Gary, do you know Mr. Richard Serino? Serino? I don't know.
Rich Serino. Yeah.
Serino, thank you.
Yeah, he serves on NEMSAC with me. He's a great guy.
Do you think this is a good thing for FEMA and for EMS?
Oh, I think it is. I'm in Boston right now where he serves as chief of EMS, and it's a third service operation, and they do a great job here.
And do you know when he takes his official office?
I haven't heard that yet. The other big news from last week was Dr. Alex Garza being nominated to head up the Office of Health Affairs of the Department of Homeland Security. That's also a great move. Alex was an EMT before becoming a physician, and in a former life was the medical director for MAST. And so two really good pieces of news over the last 7 days.
And do you foresee, with this high stature of a person that at least has some EMS background in the federal government, do you see some more money coming our way, or am I just crazy for thinking that?
Absolutely.
Well, that's really up to us. We have to be active in the political process, and that's one thing where we fail miserably. So if that's going to be, that's really up to us. The agencies can propose to do certain things, but Congress controls the budget, and if we want more money, we need to be working with Congress.
Well, Gary faded out there at the end, but I think he said Congress controls the budget, and we control our destiny. So I think that's probably about true.
Yeah, that's the point.
What is it?
Okay.
What exactly are the responsibilities of this post, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm not sure. Are you talking about Rich Serino's?
Yes.
I'm not sure. I think he was listed as deputy director of FEMA. So a deputy director, you know, fills in if there's any absence of the director. But he'll have a large operational role. Boston has done a lot with MCI work. They've got a system here in handling MCIs that's really different from most places in the country that Rich really shepherded into that system. Having Alex Garza in the other role will be significant because the role that the Office of Health Affairs has with FICOMS and with helping to spearhead some of the projects and cross-agency budget work that goes on to some of the project that this is able to get finalized kind of out the door. There's a kind of a sharing between CDC and DHS and HHS, and it's to pool funds together to make projects happen. That works really well.
So do we, and his role is not to take the fall when the director goes, well, yeah, I thought that his responsibility was to plan for this big disaster of a hurricane.
Well, it's a political appointment, and there's a reason for that. And somebody will take the fall when something bad happens, and it's always one of them.
Well, I guess that's why us political types always exist, to take the fall for the people that are elected to do the job. Well, anyway. So I at least wish him the best, because I think that having a person in this role is imperative to EMS, and maybe for once I actually feel like we have a seat at the table, and I think that's awesome. So I applaud the president for picking him and for at least having the foresight and vision to vet him and let him come through that process, because I think it's great. Any other thoughts or suggestions?
Well,
I think we should support both those guys in the new role that they have, and they'll certainly be open to hearing from all of us, and they'll have an opportunity to advance some new ideas, potentially some new ways of doing business, and I think they'll both be good research supporters and trying to see what the data says before making decisions. That's a role that both of them play really well.
Okay. Sorry, Gary, you're still fading out. Well, I do agree with you, and I think that it is going to be something that's important for the future of our industry. So we're going to wrap up this edition of the EMS Garage, because we are running right at our 45 minutes, and I'm turning over a new leaf. I'm really trying to make it shorter. I know in the future.
Oh, we're not going to talk for 2 hours?
Well, you know, we probably will off the air. But, you know,
all right, yeah.
You know, I'm sure in the next few weeks we'll go back to the normal hour and 28 minutes that we've been running. But, oh, well, it's fine now. So, Buck, give me all of your contact information on Twitter, and where can people follow you and find you and all those good things.
Well, if we're not having a Windows update, you can usually get me. You can get me on Twitter at Buckman, BUCKMAN. You can reach me on my new website, and please go down and listen to that and check it out and give me some feedback. CopyCode3.com. And, of course, you can always catch me at my silly little blog, Gomerville.com, as well.
Very cool. Well, I can't wait to hear the next edition of CopyCode 3. And
it's coming. Oh, I'll give you a little teaser there. We're talking to Tom Reynolds.
Ooh.
And I spent a long time. Yeah, I really like Tom. We spent a long time talking the other night, about a couple of hours. And we're going to edit that down to the highlights, of course. But it should be a really good conversation.
Very nice. Gary Wingrove? Oh, wait, Buck, are you going to be in? You're going to be at EMS Expo.
Oh, yeah, we should start talking. Are we free to kind of let the cat out of the bag?
Not yet. I'll do that here in a minute. So let's do it at the end.
Okay. Oh, you're going to do that? Yes,
yeah,
I will be.
Yeah. Okay, all right, good. Hey, Gary, how are you? What are you up to, and what are you doing next?
Well, here in Boston for part of the AAA meeting before I head back for that big birthday party. And what is next week? Oh, next week I'll be in Arkansas.
Ooh. Sorry?
No, I like Arkansas. It's a great place to go visit, and it's for the Advisory Board of the Rural Domestic Preparedness Consortium.
Very nice. And are you perhaps coming to Colorado soon, maybe?
I think I might be, maybe toward the end of the month.
Yes, I hope so. That would be great.
Should I
have you.
Should I book my flight?
I'm working on it. Let's talk tomorrow.
Okay.
Mr. Rob Terrio from Ontario / Orlando / Disney World, Worlds of Fun, whatever the case may be.
Hey, Chris, thanks for having me on EMS Garage tonight. You know, I think this is a good topic, and might be even worth another podcast to talk about this whole, especially this concept of oxygenation versus ventilation. And it was good to have Mark's perspective from the UK on oxygen therapy, because I think they are on the right path. I think, you know, the key with oxygen therapy is having rationale for it and not just, you know, giving it willy-nilly. So I think there's some more interesting discussion to have around that. You know, you think about patients who are hyperventilating, how many of us, how many paramedics, how many EMTs withhold oxygen for those patients? And, you know, is there any harm to giving oxygen to those patients? And the answer might surprise a lot of people. So, you know, I want to thank Mark for bringing this topic, in tonight. And, thank you guys for having me. And, you can reach me at, paramedictutor.wordpress.com. That's my blog. And, I'm on EMS Educast on a fairly regular basis. And thanks again.
Hey, Rob.
Yeah, go ahead.
On the Educast, I know you've been at your conference and everything, but me and Greg have been talking a lot. We're thinking about putting a journal group together for the Educast that meets online every couple of weeks, and we'll record the results of that. I think the first journal group / fight we're going to have is about this oxygen topic. So we may get really in-depth into it here in about a month or two.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and I'm hoping.
Yeah, that sounds interesting.
I'm hoping when we talk about it next time that we could talk to Dr. Wesley. He actually emailed me in the middle of the podcast and said, sorry, I'm late. I had run review tonight with all my people. Blah blah blah. He had this long rant about how people shouldn't be giving fentanyl. Blah blah blah. I don't know. Something about dinosaurs and sticks and whatever. So anyway, I'm sure we'll see him soon. Mark, how are you? Where can we find you? I'm sure you have a great blog that we need to hear about.
Yeah, just on my blog. I try and post every day on there now. That's at medicblog999.wordpress.com. That's my main one. Also, I haven't mentioned before, the Handover Blog Carnival, which we run, which is just a monthly gathering of various bloggers on a certain topic, and that can be found at thehandover.wordpress.com. And they're just the two things I do, and that's it.
And you run calls, and you're a dad, and all the little things.
Here's another topic, Chris.
Yeah.
Hey, Chris, I think we should change our emergency number in North America to 999. Doesn't that make more sense than 911?
Right, because you actually have to move your finger.
Exactly.
I agree.
Hey, here's just another quick thing before you go. The latest thing that is causing controversy over here in our services starting at Northeast is that as well as 999, we're now, by the end of the year, we're going to be having 111, which is for patients to ring for when they get it wrong and it's not really an emergency. So that's going to be an urgent response line. So that's going to cause some confusion, but it's possibly going to be really good.
Oh. Except for all the Yanks that come over there and dial 911, and then they go, oh, that's not right, and then they dial 111, and then they go, that's not right, I need to dial the 999. Wait.
Well, see, if 999 is for emergencies and 111 is for minor calls, then 911 will be something in between, so that could be a good thing.
Ooh, smart. Or I was thinking 555, because it's right in the line. Never mind. Sorry. You have to see my crazy nightmare of a brain working.
Phone call to nowhere.
That's great. Hey, well, thank you guys for joining us. And I am Chris Montero. You can find me. You can find my crazy, weird ramblings at chrismontero.com. That's my blog that I just started. Sorry if you're listening and want to read it. Go ahead, because it's really crazy. And I talk about all my innermost thoughts there, and it's really strange. But if you really want to catch me, go to all the social media websites. Look at Facebook, Twitter. Look for Geeky Medic and look me up. And finally, we are going to be at EMS Expo. I'm going to let the cat out of the bag 2 days early because I think it's going to happen. And Buck and I and possibly a few other of the EMS Garage people. I know the Pod Medic, Jamie Davis, will be there. And you've heard Thaddeus from the... What's that movie, Buck?
Level Zero.
Thank you, Level Zero. He'll be there as well. And we're going to be doing some really cool things and more on that to come. But start watching for the EMS Expo live on Twitter, and you'll be able to follow us and start looking for interesting and little new things. And I have a feeling we'll even have some giveaways while we're out there too. So start listening to the podcast a little bit more recent, regularly, sorry, not recently, listen to it more regularly, and you'll find out more information about what's going on at the Expo October 26th through the 30th of this year, and we'll see you down there in Atlanta, Georgia. It sounds like it's going to be nice. Hopefully it won't be too hot during that time of year, and it'll be fun. So thanks, guys. Thanks for joining us on this EMS Garage.